If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
Put your hands together there, Kim Gordon. Steve Bergman here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on a Wednesday afternoon, 9 minutes after 12 o'clock on this Wednesday afternoon. Terry Savage joins us, as she does most Wednesdays. A little bit later today, Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business will be here. And we're going to talk about Uber drivers with Frank, among other things, the Soho House, too, which is something I just learned about. And now apparently it's going to be sold. So that's coming up a little bit later. Right now we say good afternoon to Terry Savage, who's in Washington, D.C. She's going to be part of the big meeting with Paul Ryan and Donald Trump tomorrow. Correct, Terry?
I'll be in that meeting, but I am here in our nation's capital. I always like to come to what our money go to work for us. And if you get a little hollow echo, I'm in the marble halls in a quiet corner.
Are you actually seeing our money work for us or work against us?
Absolutely. Washington doesn't do anything, right? All the money and everything that's built here and all the people in general, I mean, a major part of it is our tax dollars sent here to help us. And so I'm fascinated. We just heard a presentation this morning from both Democratic and Republican high in the party staffers about how this election will work out. It's very interesting. There's a whole different tone in Washington, kind of shock and amazement at how this political year is moving forward.
So did you have separate sessions, you said, with Republicans and with Democrats?
Actually, a panel. Last night I heard our own Senator Dick Durbin, who acknowledged that, you know, nothing much is happening now because of all the political activity. And then, of course, it's summer and they always leave and then there are conventions. And so some important things are not getting done. Spending bills are not getting done. A hearing on a potential Supreme Court nominee is not getting done. But maybe, you know, it's better that nothing gets done in Washington. That's always been my attitude.
There are many people who think that. There will be this meeting tomorrow, Trump and House Speaker Ryan. Then I think Donald Trump goes over to the Senate side and will meet with some Senate Republicans as well. He made a little news today. He did an interview with the Associated Press, and he said he's not going to release his tax returns until after the November election, which is silly because he's not going to release them after the November election. Why would he? So, you know, he said, so essentially saying, look, you're not going to get a chance to see my taxes.
Okay, that's the first promise he broke, because he said he would release the tax returns.
Right. It's nuanced a little bit. It's nuanced a little bit because he's saying, you know, they're still going to be under audit review. And
that doesn't matter. He sent in what he sent in,
right,
and that's what he should release. This is nonpartisan. The fact is, though, there's no law that requires any candidate to disclose his or her tax return. However, it's been since 76 a tradition that every presidential candidate do that, and he said he would. And there's a great fascination with what his tax returns might show. Not just the headline numbers, like how much money did he make or how much did he pay in taxes. But, you know, you don't find out about someone's net worth from a tax return because it's all about income. But you see the sources of income.
Well,
was it ordinary income? Was it capital gain? Can we tell if it's revenue from licensing his name or profits from building businesses? So, and along with the other side of the return, the deductions. I mean, what is he deducting? And has he converted ordinary income into capital gains? And bottom line is he's railed at Hillary, you know, for speaking to Wall Street. We might find out that he's one of the biggest players, and his supporters will find out that he's one of the big players that they are all upset about. So that tax return is going to be a charged issue, I think, going forward.
Well, the thing about Donald Trump is he's been able to do whatever he wants, and it doesn't really cost him. You know, people think it's going to cost him, and then it turns out he doesn't. So he declared today, he says, you know what, there's no regulation or law that I do, which you said. And he also said, people don't really learn much from it. And he said, the American people don't really care much. I mean, do you think that in the end, this is something that they will care about?
I think in this reality show world, that was a promise that was made. There are a lot of people interested in looking, and you do learn a lot. For years and years and years, I've told spouses, be sure that if you're signing a joint return, you read that return. You take a look at where the income comes from. Do you know that there's an investment over there and the income's declared on your return? You should know about that. Do you know what these deductions are for? There is no such thing as an innocent spouse, and I think there's no such thing as an innocent candidate, and that it's a mistake for the press to just let this thing slide. Well, I think it was a promise made, and the people will be interested.
It clearly was a promise made in one way or another. And, you know, that's my point, Terry, and we can move on here. But it's not that the press will let it slide. They might beat their chests and run up and down. But if it doesn't resonate with people, like a lot of the things against Donald Trump haven't resonated with Republican primary voters, it's not going to matter that much. And so we'll see if this one does. I don't know. Would it show up if Donald Trump was shopping at Macy's on his tax return? Probably not.
No, that won't show up. He's not going to reveal what his credit card charges are. But he will reveal, you know, this is not pro-Trump or anti-Trump, but Hillary Clinton revealed her tax returns, which showed the income she made from speaking engagements. So that has been a key point from those who, you know, wanted to track from her candidacy, that she spoke to Wall Street and got a lot of money as she'd be holding to them.
It really is.
It goes both ways then.
It is a little delicious that this guy is running not on his record in government, because he doesn't have one, but on his record in business. And in a way that he might sort of offer some proof of his success in business, he's going to take a pass on it. But I brought up Macy's because they had some numbers out, and I think they were blaming low tourism, but some bad retail numbers for Macy's this week.
Yes, the entire consumer segment of the economy is showing some weakness. It was surprising. Macy's was a key number. We'll see Nordstrom's later tonight. You know, we live in an internet world. Macy's for the last 4 years has been very promotional. You walk in that store and everything is always 25% off, and I do walk in that store from time to time, but less, as does everyone, because you shop online. And the question is a race to the bottom. Can they sell enough stores? Can they cut enough costs to be profitable? Or will the American consumer just bypass the bricks and mortar stores? It's a serious issue. It's a serious issue because some of the good hiring that's come up in the jobs market in the last quarter was at retail. But if people aren't going into the stores, then you're going to see not only a direct impact on the stocks of these companies, but on the jobs that they are expected to provide over the summer.
You know, you're echoing in a way what Office Max and Office Depot have been saying, too. You know, the federal judge upheld the federal government's move to block their merger, but those two companies say, look, people are shopping online. We need to do all we can to keep these bricks and mortar stores alive. And they say that without the merger, it's going to be tough to do that.
You know, by the time you get to be a federal judge, I think by definition you're older, but you need to talk to your children or grandchildren about where commerce is done today. And I think that was a generation gap kind of ruling, because it's true that both Office Depot and Staples face huge competition from online. And you're going to see, as a result of this denial of that merger, people worry two big companies merge and jobs are lost.
Right.
But if you didn't let them merge and become profitable and grow because of this outdated idea that they are the only competitors in the market, what you're going to see is more stores closing and more jobs lost. So our economic world has raced far ahead of our regulatory world and of the judiciary in an understanding of where commerce is going.
That's Terry Savage. She's in Washington today. You could read more from her at TerrySavage.com. I want you to take a break here. We're going to put you on hold. And when we come back, you are going to explain to me everything I need to know about muni bonds. How's that sound?
All right, fine.
We'll take all the time you need. It's 12:22. You're listening to the Windfirst Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Terry Savage joins us, as she does most Wednesdays. She is in Washington today watching the government leaders spend your money. Terry, thanks for taking the time of your busy schedule. I appreciate it.
I am delighted to be with you from the hallowed marble halls of the Capitol.
Now, you've talked about negative interest rates and low yields and all of that. One of the columns that you've written recently at TerrySavage.com has to do with muni bonds and the fact that there can be a payoff there, right? The yields can be better, or maybe they can't. Tell me about it.
Well, that's the question. I'm doing a series of columns because on my blog at terrysavage.com where people post questions, I can guarantee that every day I'll get a question from someone saying, you know, I plan to live on my interest. The savings rates are so low. I don't earn any interest. But could I go buy this because it offers a higher yield? And risk and reward are the opposite sides of the coin. And if there's a higher yield, there's always more risk. So this column that I just posted is about the attractiveness of municipal bonds. It's twofold. First of all, the interest rates are far higher than the money you're going to get in your money market account. And second of all, for that interest is tax-free on your federal return and maybe tax-free on your state return if you buy the bonds of the state that issues them. But the risk, there's a reason. I really support the city of Chicago, but did you really want to lend money to the city of Chicago, which managed to sell hundreds of millions of dollars of bonds just a few weeks ago? But they had to pay almost 5% interest. So everybody's ears perked up, but we know what a tough situation the city's in. How it's going to pay its bills is questionable.
So that's the point, right? If you're going to buy a municipal bond, and say the Chicago bonds, you're buying into the idea that they're going to be able to turn the pension system or things around and pay you off down the road.
This is your chance to make a bet on that, and I consider it a very risky bet, given the headlines that we see in the paper every day. They're not doing anything about the issues that are going to confront us in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years with the public schools, with all kinds of issues, and particularly the pensions running out of money. Puerto Rico just defaulted on some of its bonds, and they can't go bankrupt. They're a commonwealth, and they may default on more. So, yeah, you enjoy a higher yield, but do you sleep well at night? I made a very important point now about municipal bonds is, in general, they used to be considered, of course, all bonds are rated, so the ones that pay the most interest are the lowest rated. It used to be that you wanted to buy a general obligation of a city and state, figuring they've raised taxes enough to pay the interest on their bonds. A lot of sophisticated bond buyers now are saying, you know, I just want to buy revenue bonds where there's an ongoing activity like a toll road or an airport where I know the revenue will come in, not dependent on what the city legislators or state legislators vote.
Okay, so let's go over that again. So there's a general obligation bond, which is just from the general funds. But these revenue bonds you talk about, like say they want to build a new stadium and they're selling revenue bonds to build that stadium, then your return would be dependent on the revenue coming in from that stadium's operations.
Exactly.
Which
now,
is maybe a little more dependable.
On a team for 30 years to bring in revenue, but an airport, you're pretty sure that if there are airport revenue bonds, that they're going to be able to charge the landing fees. So that kind of could be a more secure stream of income than the general IOU from a city or state.
Okay, we've only got a minute left, but I want to ask you, though, because I can't go to a counter and buy a City of Chicago bond, right? It's kind of hard for individual investors to do it.
Individual investors get the most ripped off by buying municipal bonds because you don't see the prices. If you go to terrysavage.com and read this column, there's a link to the one website, Emma, which is the site that gives you current price information on almost any municipal bond. But my advice is if you're going to buy munis, buy them in a bond fund, an open-end fund managed by the Fidelities or Vanguards of the world or a trust that's traded on an exchange. You do not want to be buying and selling individual issues of munis. Guaranteed, they'll make you pay too much to buy them, and they won't give you enough when you sell them.
That's Terry Savage. Terry, have a safe trip back to Chicago. It's great to talk to you again.
Be in studio next week, Steve.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business is in the studio, sponsored by Allstate today, to talk about a few of the stories in Cranes. Frank, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Steve.
You will familiar face you. Did you walk or did you take an Uber?
I walked, but I think I saw 20 Ubers on my way over the bridge.
Do they have? I saw Lyft has little signs in the window. Do Uber drivers too?
Absolutely. And I think the number I'm seeing now, it's pretty soon it's going to be just Uber drivers driving around picking up broken down Lyft drivers and vice versa.
Right. They'll be giving each other lifts.
Yeah.
I didn't mean it that way. But there's a movement. I know there's a movement in New York to sort of organize these drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And then as part of that lawsuit settlement, I think the Massachusetts, California case, I think there was some allowance for them to organize in one way or another. I don't know. But you guys are writing about a sort of a organization or federation here in Chicago. Tell me about that.
That's right. About 30,000 people currently drive for Uber in any given month in the Chicago region, and then there's a bunch more for Lyft. They're classified those independent contractors everywhere, so they don't have the federal labor law protection that employees do. Several drivers are banding together in the Chicago area to form an association. It's not a union, to try to get better pay, better treatment from these ride-sharing companies, and the association is called Drive Number 4 Chicago, Drive for Chicago.
I got it. And so the part of the article is that these people who are forming this, they say, look, we're not making the cash that Uber says we're making.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised at how low. The one driver, John Rice, who has formed this association, estimates he makes $9 to $12 an hour, and that is without depreciation of his car factored in.
So what does Uber say?
Well, Uber says they'll talk to any driver and that they'll meet with these groups. And as you say, they just settled these class action suits in California and Massachusetts. And as part of those settlements, they actually agreed to create new drivers associations in those states. And in New York, as you say, there's 1,000 people now in a new drivers organization. And the Teamsters are backing a group in California. So and we've got New Jersey. There's some bubbling up of these nascent labor movements for these drivers. So it does seem like they need to sit up and pay attention. Lyft did not comment in response to the story, but Uber did say, you know, they'll meet with anybody.
Well, it's a weird thing because if I can speak for Uber, they're like, hey, we're not making you drive for us.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's your choice. Here's what we pay. And I know that we don't. Now, we had Marco McCautry was in here last week, I think, or the week before. And I asked him about it. He said that Uber drivers can get tips, as I recall, but it's not in the app yet, right?
Right, and that's one of the pushback areas. Uber does not want to put the tip into the app as like a service charge because then that raises the rate, and the drivers say if there's not a tip in there, we often don't get tips. And so, you know, the Uber spokesperson says, of course, as you say, drivers are their own boss. They control their own schedules, earn money whenever they want. So, you know, that's the way it is. But, yeah, things like that are kind of the bones of contention. And, you know, there's a lot of money to go around because Uber is currently valued at $62.5 billion and Lyft is worth $5.5 billion.
Yeah, but do you know what office space goes for in San Francisco?
I mean, that's just 2 months' rent.
And the furniture, it's tough, yeah. Well, it's interesting because, it's a disruptor, these companies, and I'm sure the people who are running Uber and Lyft knew stuff like this was coming. It's only natural, and we'll see sort of how it works out.
Yeah.
Millennials and apartment buildings. This is a great story. I'm interested in, you know, they talk about the millennials, who many of whom might have come of age during the stock crisis or the Wall Street crisis. So they're bigger savers, but they're not Wall Street investors.
That's right. They stayed at home longer, maybe. They maybe don't have a job that allows them to qualify for a mortgage. They're more interested in this communal living kinds of situations that you're seeing. I know there's a South Loop apartment building that's going to be like dorm-like living for adults.
Really?
Yeah, out of college. There'll be some college students probably, but it'll be young professionals as well. So, there's a study now. Researchers at DePaul University Institute for Housing Studies say that millennials, you know, they're holding off on the home purchases, staying in apartments longer than previous generations. And so those folks, renters age 25 to 34, especially who earn $74,000 a year or more, so at the higher end of the scale, they accounted for most of the increase in demand for apartments in Cook County between 2007 and 2014. They are the ones who are driving all this luxury apartment building boom, more so than any other cohort.
And with that salary, those are the people who used to be buying condos or buying their first home.
Exactly. Like they get that first condo. And now renters in that age range account for 31.2% of all Cook County renter households in 2014, and that's up from 25.7% in 2007. So that's a really significant hike.
I remember in the 90s when parents were buying their kids' houses.
It didn't happen for me.
It didn't happen for me either, but I could remember a few people like, well, you know, the value's going to go up. We're just going to buy them a house.
Yeah.
Save them the money. Well, it probably didn't work out that well for a lot of them.
No, unless they held on for, you know, 25 years.
Rode their way through it. But so there's a big apartment building boom in Chicago. I know that's the case. Is that for these people?
Yeah. Developers have built almost 8,000 rental units in downtown Chicago over the past 3 years, and they're going to add almost 9,000 more by the end of 2017. And like this study finds, about 40%, you know, of there's been a 40% increase in renters of the millennial generation. So they're snapping up a lot of those units.
And here's the rub then, because these guys are people of some wealth who are renting apartments. And if you're a landlord, that's who you're going to go after.
Right.
And that leaves the people who are, I'll use the term below, below when it comes to income, who might have to live in an apartment, rely on an apartment. There aren't as many affordable apartments around.
Yeah, so the gap is growing between the haves and the have-nots. The study also found that people who are housing poor, in other words, they spend more than 30% of their income on apartments, that is 52% of renter households. They're rent burdened. They have to spend more than a third, which is considered to be, you know, you're doing fine
sure.
if you spend a third. And that's compared to 49% nationwide. So we're a little worse than the national average for rent burdening. And those households earning only 30 to 50% of the area's median income, you know, as you might expect, are having the hardest time finding affordable apartments.
I would imagine a lot of those people probably used to, back in the day, live in the Fulton Market area.
Yeah, that's right. That's had the meat packers and some affordable housing back in the day.
Not so much anymore, Frank. I don't think there's a lot of affordable housing around there, is there?
No, and the tip of the spear for that in terms of developments, you had the Restaurant Row starting up, and then other developers started to come in with offices, condos, hotels, and one of the first ones was Soho House, which was opened in 2014.
Now, I'd never heard of Soho House, and I ran into, there's a novelist, Chuck Pavone, wrote a book called The Travelers. You should read it.
Okay.
And I was talking to him, and he said, yeah, I'm just staying over at the Soho House. I'm like, what's that? And he said it started in London, maybe, or New York, and was sort of arts-based, where writers and artists would hang out.
Yeah, it's an artsy, hipstery club slash hotel slash restaurant slash, you know, they've got several restaurants and bars, and it's a place where you can hang out and work on your laptop next to the pool.
And now they're going to sell the one in Chicago, looks like, for $125 million?
Yeah, they're looking at that as probably the windfall. $125 million versus the about $64 million that the refi cost for this former industrial building in 2015. So you're looking at probably more than doubling what was invested in there. So being a first mover into the West Loop as a developer paid off. Now, Soho House is not going to move. They have a lease that runs for almost another 20 years. So it would just be they'd have a different landlord.
Okay, so next week when you come back, I want you to find the next spot like that, and we can invest somewhere together.
But can we talk about it off air?
Let's do it off the air, right. Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business. Great to see you, friend.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, have you been hearing about Facebook and whether they're culling material from conservative magazines or things like that? I've been trying to understand that, and it seems as if every time I hear a different report, it's a bit of a different story. We're going to talk to Ben Rubin from CNET. He's on a phone line now. Ben, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, how are you?
I'm Thanks doing well, thanks.
Me.
Nice to talk to you. Now, I want to talk to you about Amazon Video, and I told everyone I would do that. But before we get there, talk to me a little bit about this Facebook story, because I know even the White House is commenting on it, and they were comparing it to the IRS investigating conservative groups and all of this stuff. Explain for me what exactly is going on with Facebook and this culling.
Yeah, so the tech blog Gizmodo posted some report citing anonymous sources that had worked at Facebook. They were contractors at Facebook that were working on that trending topics box. If you recall, when you go on Facebook, they have this box on the side that said, here's the big news of the day that you should be paying attention to. What the Gizmodo stories claimed, there was one in particular, it said that Facebook was deliberately leaving out conservative websites or conservative-related stories.
So, you know, I tend to think that all of these things – I tend to think all these things are – they're using algorithms for everything, right? It's automatic. If it's hot, that's based on raw data, and it's pushed up there. Are you telling me humans are deciding what goes on that list?
Yeah. According to the stories, they said that humans were helping the algorithm, so it was kind of like a human-robot pairing where
okay. –
The trending topics were surfaced in a way through the robots, and then humans would then figure out, they would curate the list a little bit further.
We're going to bag that one. We're going to bag this one. Yeah, I get it now. So what does Facebook say that they were in the wrong? Are they going to change anything or did it not happen or?
Facebook flatly denied this, and they said that, you know, this whole story is bunk. We do mostly use robots, and they denied the Gizmodo report. The problem with the Gizmodo report is that it obviously used anonymous sourcing, so it's not like we can then go back and try to verify or clarify what was actually reported already.
You know, the business lunch here on WGN has never been on that trending box, and I now choose to believe that that's probably one of those knuckleheads knocking us out.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility.
I feel much better about myself now, Ben.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about this is how important Facebook has now become as a news source for people, right? I mean, like, that's the whole reason that people are getting so excited about this story, that, you know, this claim that Facebook's trending topics is somehow biased in some way. People are getting upset about it because they use Facebook so often to find out what the news of the day is.
Yeah, they're getting upset about it because it matters now. Let's go to Amazon and this Video Direct. Now, as I understand it, Amazon Video Direct, or AVD, they're hoping that they will one day challenge YouTube or an alternative to YouTube, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this is a new open platform for Amazon. It's mostly targeted at professionals, professional studios, maybe even student films at film schools, different things like that. But the concept here, the idea is that Amazon could then bring in a lot of new videos, new content, and then not have to pay for it up front, which, you know, potentially could help them go up against YouTube and have more content.
I was just listening to someone from AMC, the channel, and said they've created this online documentary portal where they've got all the biggest curation of documentaries ever known, and it's the same sort of thing. They want people to log on there and watch documentaries. Kind of an interesting thing. But I also read at CNET that Amazon, I didn't know this, that Amazon Prime Video is going to be a standalone, so I can pay for just the television shows soon on Amazon, and I don't have to pay for the free delivery and all of that?
Yes, yeah, exactly. But they still tried to make it pretty much, they're still trying to get everybody to do the free delivery and get the full service.
Yeah, so I won't be saving much, right?
Right. You get the full service, which includes all these different goodies for $11 a month. That's also a monthly service, or you can get it for $99 a year, or you can just get the streaming video service for $9 a month. So because they're now providing that streaming video service as its own thing, that is part of the reason why they started doing this thing, Video Direct, to potentially bolster up that video
service. And I got sucked in because of their a couple of their original shows I wanted to watch, and I'm just about at the end of my 30 days for free. I don't like a lot of the other stuff. I know they're going to work on getting more programming, so I look forward to that. Ben Rubin,
I really
from
CNET. I like Man in the High Castle, by the way. I don't know if you saw it. Man in the High Castle. I thought that one was a really good show.
I'll have to check that out. I was watching Mozart in the Jungle and Catastrophe. Man in the High Castle. All right, look, you gave me great advice today. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Absolutely.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WG.